Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education, your weekly guide to education matters in Ireland and further afield. You can get in touch with me through Twitter at InsideEd, by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie or through the programme's website insideed.com. If you're an educator with a story to tell or an event to highlight, please contact me, Sean Delaney, and I'll do my best to feature it on a future programme. On this week's programme, I bring you the second part of my interview with Professor Áine Hyland. She is Professor Emeritus from University College Cork and a key player in the establishment of the Dawkey School project. On last week's programme, Áine told us how she came to be involved in the Dawkey School project, and we discussed her career in the civil service and in academia. In this second part of the interview, we find out about her interest in multiple intelligences, about her successes and failures in influencing educational policy, who inspired her, and much more. To begin with, I noted that an area of interest for Áine Hyland when she was in UCC was multiple intelligences, so I asked her how she became interested in multiple intelligences.
People say to me, you went in onto all kinds of different directions, but of course I never really saw it that way. I saw myself as having an interest in the inclusion of all children, either in terms of their learning ability or disability, in terms of their religious or other background, in terms of their social background, because that's the other area, of course, I was quite active in the whole area. We set up a major project on what we call Bridging the Gap, and I chaired the Statutory Educational Disadvantage Committee. I was quite involved in the whole area of educational disadvantage. But to me, this sort of, if you like, overriding issue was inclusion and diversity. Inclusion, whether the diversity was intellectual or whether it was ability or disability, whether it was religious or whether it was social. As far as I was concerned, education has a major role to play in helping to bring people of all backgrounds together and working with them in the same environment, the same learning environment. So I never saw them as different.
I had a guest on this programme a few weeks ago, and he was quite dismissive of the idea. He referred to intelligences as dispositions, and he kind of said there's really just one true intelligence, which is intellectual. How would you respond to that criticism?
Well, I mean, for us in Ireland, the word intelligence, as it has come into the English language, doesn't really exist in the Irish language at all. I should have said, by the way, my first language is Irish. I didn't speak English until I was 6 or 7 years of age. So I'm always conscious of what we have inherited through, if you like, the Irish language. There isn't a word for intelligence in Irish. In fact, the word intelligent in English is a relatively new word. You don't get that word in Plato or in Socrates or in Aristotle. So intelligence is a late 19th, early 20th century concept introduced for good reason at the time to try and measure the potential of young of people. First, it was used in different contexts, in war, in soldiers, in immigrants, and so on. It was a useful way of describing, if you like, a phenomenon that they needed to describe and to get a word for. I'm very conscious of the different strengths and weaknesses that we all have. I mean, my own areas of strengths wouldn't be the same as my brothers or sisters, for example. My mother was wonderful in recognising the difference between all of our us as 13 children and building on our strengths. So I came from that kind of a background. And my father, even though he was himself very much an academic in the best sense of the word, he was very careful never to compare us. He always saw us as having different strengths. So as a family, that was where I came from. And when I started to teach, yes, sure, some children wouldn't do as well as other children. I was fortunate as well in my own education and in the convent secondary school I went to, because it was a small school, there wasn't any of this approach that you would see in other schools of being first, second, third, fourth in class. We never had that. So I didn't come from, you know, we certainly, we'd have one girl good at music and one girl good at art and one girl good at home economics. I was hopeless at home economics. I was very bad at gym, at PE, but I was very good at music. I was good at Irish. And so I always felt, yeah, we all have strengths and weaknesses. So the first time I heard Howard Gardner speaking, which was about 1993, he came to Ireland. Kathleen Lynch in UCD invited him. And I was really enthused by this as an approach. I thought this makes sense. And when I was given the opportunity by Atlantic Philanthropies to start a project in University College Cork, they would provide funding. I thought this is well worth getting involved in. In Cork, what I had found in the first few months even I was there, very high achievers in the high achieving schools, an awful lot of emphasis on high academic achievement. But I had already noticed in Cork that some of the what would now be called DESH schools were not given very much attention. And there were some excellent principals of those schools, both primary and secondary, who had contacted me to talk to me about what they might be able to do for children in their schools who were not achieving academically. And so they immediately, once they had heard the Howard Gardner concepts and that I had this idea of doing something very vague in Cork, they said, well, look, we'd be delighted to work with you. So in fact, what happened was I set up a project quite early on, by the mid-1990s in Cork, on multiple intelligences, curriculum and assessment, how the theory of multiple intelligences, would it be possible to apply it in the Irish context, taking account of our primary school curriculum and of our junior cert and leaving cert programmes. So I worked with both primary and second level schools. We had a great project going in which the theories were, we were translating the theories into pedagogies and approaches to teaching and learning. Teachers were applying them, reporting back to me. We were documenting the work of the students, the work of the teachers. But basically it was within an Irish context. Your question, why intelligences? My answer to that is, why not intelligences? It's a word. It has a meaning that has been given to it by human people. We can give it a different meaning for the context of this work. And that, of course, is what Gardner would say. Why not call them intelligences? Dispositions, talents, you can use whatever word you want, but we choose to use the word intelligences. What we could see straight away was that children who had not been achieving under more traditional linguistic and logical approaches to teaching and learning, in many cases, they were able to relate better when the entry points were different, when their other intelligences were being activated for learning. And, I mean, I've written about this, and I think myself, looking back on it, I think a very important factor was the fact that we as teachers, all of us, said we're no longer going to go into a classroom and categorise our children by intelligent or not intelligent. It's up to us as teachers to say, in what way is this child intelligent? Recognising that every child has some intelligence to bring. And I think it was a whole mindset and a way of thinking about children and about their learning. And they, in turn, responded positively. Not all of them, of course, but the whole environment changed, the way of thinking changed. And from a teacher's point of view, it meant the challenge is, for me as a teacher, how am I going to engage these children? How am I going to identify their intelligences and build on them?
We move on to another area of interest to you, which is policy development. And you've sat on many boards and committees and bodies like to do with curriculum and examinations, special education, higher education, the point system, education disadvantage and so on. And many ministers use these as a way of driving policy. But what is the secret to a successful committee, that it produces work that doesn't just sit on a shelf and that actually makes it into practice, as opposed to the ones that don't make it into practice? Yeah.
That's a very good question. And I mean, I would be the first to say some of our committees were successful, some of them weren't. Thinking of the Curriculum and Examinations Board, it's 30 years ago since it reported, and many of its recommendations, most of its recommendations, were never put into practice. It did, however, set a base for subsequent curriculum development. And I guess sometimes that's the best you can hope for. Under the inspired leadership of Ed Walsh, we were probably a little bit too radical, the first Curriculum and Examinations Board. Our expectations were probably too high, and therefore we didn't immediately achieve very much. The dilemma is, will a committee be so incrementalist that the pace of change will be a snail's pace, or will you be so radical that nothing at all happens? And I mean, that's I suppose putting two extremes beside each other. The Special Education Review Committee, in some sense, in terms of what happened and the outcome of it, was probably one of the more successful committees I was on, although I found it quite frustrating at the time because I felt we were very conservative. For example, looking back on it now, it's probably one of my greater embarrassments. Autism, for example, which was beginning to be recognised, certainly by the parents who were coping with autism and Asperger's children, as a real issue. There's no section at all on autism. There's, I think, a paragraph or two in that report that just says, well, autism is a form of moderate mental disability. That's the language of the time, which we now know is totally incorrect. One of my grandchildren is on the Asperger's spectrum, and I cringe when I read the Special Education Review Committee, because Asperger's had been identified internationally at that time. We don't mention it at all as an issue to be addressed in special education. And yet it's a very important issue now. And yet the way forward, as we saw it in that report, has in fact influenced policy almost immediately. I suppose there was a timeliness. We were the right report at the right time. Ireland was getting ready to move away from segregating children with special needs in special schools to integrating them. And the Special Education Review Committee came up with a framework under which the resources would be provided for them. And the other thing, which I would never underestimate, it's always a very good idea to try and have key policy makers from within the Department of Education and Skills on the committee or on the board or whatever it is, and to ensure that you get buy-in from them, that they are buying in to the solutions that are being proposed, because they're sitting behind their desk in the department the following day, and if they believe in the solutions that are coming forward, you have a much better chance of them being implemented. I mean, my biggest disappointment was the Educational Disadvantage Committee, which reported around 1994-95. We did have people from the department on that committee, but what I didn't know is that separately to the work of our committee, they were actually developing what is now the DESH policy. Now, much of the DESH policy is based on some of the discussions we had in the Disadvantage Committee, but it's a much more limited policy. It didn't look at the broader family and community environment of the children. And the Education Disadvantage Committee was very conscious that only 40% of children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds are in what are now DESH schools. And of course, nothing has ever really been done for the other 60%. So there are issues like that. The Points Commission made a huge impact, but actually nothing changed. And so we are now still 15 years later looking at the transition from second to third level and trying to get changes introduced that will ameliorate the terrible pressure on Leaving Cert students. So you can have a report that might be successful. I mean, my name was made in a way by the Points Commission report, and yet it was not a radical report, partly because we could see there was no appetite for change and there was no point in recommending change if the people of Ireland weren't going to buy into that change. So some of it is just chance, you know, the timeliness of a report. Some of it is having a minister who is ready to adopt and to adapt to the change that is being recommended.
Where then, from your view of the system, where does policy in education come from?
It comes from all kinds of different places, for all kinds of different reasons. I mean, you obviously have, coming up to an election, and we'll see it over the next 6 to 12 months, you will have subgroups of all the political parties drawing up their election manifestos. These election manifestos in turn will contribute significantly to a programme for government, if it's a coalition government, and if whether it is or isn't, but if it's particularly if it's a coalition government, because there will be compromises. So a strong minister like Rory Quinn, for example, coming in will come into power as a minister with a very clear set of objectives that he or she wants to see achieved. The problem, of course, as we've always said about politics, is that ministers, at the best of times, can only expect to survive the full term of government. Mostly they don't in Ireland. If you look back over the last 50 years, we've had a huge number of ministers, some of whom last only a year or two. The permanent secretariat in the department are crucial. There's no doubt in my mind, the longer I go on, and we're fortunate at the moment, both in the inspectorate and on the administrative side, to have men and women who have a vision for education. But obviously their vision, it contributes to the overall policy, but ultimately it's a political vision. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I mean, I can remember some of my former lecturers in university talking about politics should be separated from education. I think that's nonsense. I mean, he who pays the piper plays the tune. And in any event, it's the people of Ireland who have spoken. It's the people of Ireland who have elected the government they have elected. And it is the Minister for Education who, at least in theory, is acting on behalf of the people. And so we have to respect that. I think we've been fortunate in Ireland. We haven't had the huge pendulum swings of curriculum change that other countries have had, so that there is a respect for the professional in Ireland and a respect for our teachers. And the role of the teachers on bodies like the NCCA has been very, very significant.
How important do you think it is for teachers to have a sense of history of education?
Well, to me, it's really important, obviously, because it makes sense of so many things. History wasn't a subject I was personally interested in at all, history as such. I didn't do history for my Leaving Cert. I didn't do history in my degree. And I had opted out of history quite early on. But for me, history was a lens, a crucial lens through which I could understand education. So my love and interest in history started almost at postgraduate level when I became interested in the history of education, because it made sense of so many things. It made sense of the structure of education. It made sense of curriculum. Like looking back even to Roman and Greek times, and looking back to Socrates and looking back to Plato, and understanding the history of thought and the history of learning and the history of development, I suddenly saw the role of history. Not so much political history, although of course as time went on I began to see political history as also having a role in education. So I do think it's hugely important. You know, for example, I mean, the issues we currently have in relation to junior cycle reform, the Irish historical situation of Irish education, is you have to understand that to understand why the teachers are taking the stance they're taking, which makes no sense in the rest of the world. And I mean, I'm not supporting their stance, but I understand their stance. They have always seen the examiner and the assessor as the enemy, not as the French concept or the original meaning of assessment, which is to sit with the student and to what we now call assessment for learning. Conceptually, Irish teachers have never seen assessment as being for learning. They have seen it as a trap in which to catch the child, and their role is to protect the child and to help them to avoid that trap. So it's a very different way of thinking, and if you don't understand that, and people from outside Ireland can't understand at all why Irish teachers are so opposed to assessing their own students for certification, which other countries don't see, it's never been an issue. I think we're probably unique in the world in terms of that issue. But if you understand where we're coming from in Irish education, in the history of Irish education, you can see why they look at it that way.
From where or from whom do you and did you draw inspiration for your work in education?
Initially from my father, I have to say. My father only died within the last decade. He was so committed to education. He utterly believed in education in a way that has left all of us, most of my sisters, as you probably know, are in education. I've seven sisters, there are eight of us. And we really believed that education was what mattered, and education was what changed the world and would continue to change the world. And I guess to be a teacher was the ultimate aspiration. So later on, obviously, when you now see points being used to decide on a hierarchy of important professions, because the points are highest for medicine, then medicine is the most important profession, etc., etc. That didn't exist at all in my upbringing. Most of us in the family, boys and girls, initially had the aspiration of being teachers. And that was quite common in Ireland back in the 50s. It was the stepping stone to social progression as well as educational progression. I also was fortunate in that very small convent secondary school which I attended to have some very good teachers, and we were superb music teachers. Everybody in that school, and it was in the Midlands, which wouldn't be the most musical part of Ireland, we all played instruments. We were all in school orchestras. We were all in school choirs. Our school got the highest marks. And the teachers, our teachers, who were all nuns, had very, very high expectations for us. I came fourth in my intercert and sixth or seventh in my leaving cert in the country from a tiny little school, you know. But that was the expectation, that without any pressure, but just simply, this is something we can do. We're a small school, but we can achieve this. So I had teachers there. And then when I went on to college, obviously when I went on to UCD, I did an evening degree, and that wasn't very inspiring, but at least it got me the piece of paper, and that's what I needed to get to go on to further study. In Trinity College, I must say, Susan Parks was a wonderful inspiration to me. She was the person who lectured us on history of education. She brought it all alive in a way that began to make sense of the whole of education for me. And then when I went on to Carysfort, to Sister Regina, who was the head of the college there, was an inspirational figure in her own way. She transformed the college in a short period of time, and she saw the strengths in everybody. Again, we come back to the multiple intelligences. She recognised people had different strengths, and she, you know, created teams to develop the institution, building on the different strengths of different people. And then I have to say, when I went in a very different form of educational leadership, when I went on to UCC, Jerry Rickson, who was the president at the time, with very ambitious aims for the university and targets, you know, he achieved them in a very different way to anything I had ever experienced before. It was very single-minded, strategic, focused approach to what we now talk about as strategic planning in education. But a lot was achieved, but obviously not everybody agrees with that approach. And then philosophically, I read an awful lot. Obviously, Howard Gardner, I admire his theory, but I'd always take what I like of somebody's theory. People like Lee Shulman, whom I've had great admiration for. Probably the best part of my career were the final 7 years when I was vice president of University College Cork, and I had the opportunity to work with my colleagues across a whole range of different subjects and faculties on improving their teaching and learning. And that whole approach to the signature pedagogies of the professions got me to really wake up and realise that we as teachers, traditional teachers if you like, teacher educators, we don't have all the knowledge and the expertise, far from it. Some of our colleagues in medical education, engineering education, legal education are absolutely stunning teachers, stunning pedagogues, and we rarely, as teacher educators, look across the professions to see how other professions teach. And I think that was a huge learning for me, and something that I have enjoyed since I retired, following up on.
Looking back on your career to date, what are you most proud of professionally?
A few years ago, I said that what I was most proud of was putting teaching and learning in higher education on the map. I was very proud of that because in the late 1990s, early 2000s, there was a strong move internationally to focus on research in higher education and to leave the teaching to postgraduate students, junior lecturers and so on. In UCC, I was very fortunate to be supported by the president and by the management there to put teaching and learning on an equal footing with research. And we used the phrase in our strategic plan that University College Cork would give parity of esteem to teaching and to research. And when I went to do some work with the Carnegie Foundation, I developed the concept of the integration of research and teaching and learning, that in teaching we have to be informed by research, and ideally we have to be researchers as well as being teachers, that they're simply two sides of the same coin, that a good teacher in higher education has to be both a researcher and a teacher. Research benefits from teaching and teaching benefits from research. So that, I think, we began to change the attitude to teaching in higher education by introducing those concepts. And then I suppose in more recent years, I'm kind of both surprised but delighted to see how effective the Educate Together movement has been. But I would recognise that I was only a cog in a wheel in that development, in that there were a number of us involved in that. I've been less successful in teacher education. I came in to University College Cork as head of education, professor of education, with great dreams and ideas, partly of bringing some of the creativity of primary teacher education into post-primary teacher education. I didn't succeed. I was 7 years head of the education department there, and not much changed. But in fairness now, with the Teaching Council and the extension of what was the 9-month, 7-month HDIP to a 2-year PME, Professional Masters in Education, I'm very optimistic that that will change. And I think teacher education, the extension of the 3-year BEd to a 4-year BEd, I think all of that is very much a move in the right direction.
And that optimistic note from Áine Hyland brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank Áine for her time. If you'd like to feature an event or an idea on a future programme, you can write to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Remember, you can listen to podcasts of all previous programmes on insideed.com. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney saying goodbye. Thank you for listening.